come along with us as we explore the broad world of preservation and the work being done to preserve, interpret, and save our past in a 21st century world. From aquaculture to historic foodways to forensic modeling, we're talking weekly with experts from across the globe. This is your host, Nick Redding. Welcome to PreserveCast. This is Nick Redding. You're listening to PreserveCast. And today I'm so excited to have one of our most trusted colleagues here with us from the state of Maryland, Lauren Riviello, who is the president and CEO of the C&O Canal Trust, which is a supporting organization. And we're going to learn all about what it is that they do, but a friends group effectively of the C&O Canal National Historical Park, which is not only an amazing resource for the state of Maryland, but really for the nation. And we're going to learn all about what they do, how they do it, and an amazing program that they run that allows people to engage with historic structures in a really unique and hands-on way. I sort of think of them as a leader with this program. And we're going to talk all about Canal Quarters, which is that program, and all that good stuff. But before we get there, we love to get to know folks and how they kind of made their way into this particular career field. So, Lauren, where did you grow up and what put you on the path to where you are today?
Sure. Well, hi, Nick. Thanks very much for having me, and happy National Preservation Month. Great month to be joining you. So I grew up just outside of Shepherdstown, West Virginia, in an 1820s farmhouse. Being from outside of Shepherdstown, I grew up exploring the C&O Canal and the Lock 38 area in particular. My family lived there for over 30 years, and I saw firsthand how my parents really carefully stewarded this old home, and I got to participate in some projects too. So moving forward, I went to West Virginia University and pursued a degree in journalism. After graduating, I found myself in my first nonprofit job at the Monongalia Arts Center, which was a community arts center in Morgantown. And there, I quickly learned how to wear the many hats of a small nonprofit staff member, from marketing and communications, finance, some curatorial work of exhibitions, and janitorial work. I fell in love. That art center is located in the historic old Morgantown post office that was built in the early 1900s. And it was really my first real experience working in a historic building that had been converted into a space for public use, which meant it was being cared for regularly as it was occupied. So I learned how to deal really quickly with, you know, an old boiler issue, a leaking roof. And after years there, my now husband and I moved to Boston, where I found myself at a few different arts-focused nonprofits and eventually solely at the Brookline Arts Center, which is also located in the historic building. It was an old chemical fire station that was built in 1886. So while there, while leading the Arts Center, I also learned more about historic preservation and worked through a few really, really interesting rehabilitation projects. My family and I finally decided to move back to the Eastern Panhandle in 2021, and the Director of Development Opportunity with the C&O Canal Trust presented itself. And it was really the perfect amalgamation of my experience and career development. So now my family and I live in an old colonial home in Charlestown. It was built in 1900, and my daughter is now participating in some of the same projects that I did when I was young.
So you're putting her on the path as well.
Trying to.
Yeah. So it's interesting. We've talked to a lot of different people who end up in preservation or museum work. And there are a lot of people who know instantly that they want to get into it. And then there's a good chunk of people that have to go back and like think through it, but many who have mentioned journalism. And I wonder if there's a thread there in an interest in storytelling. I mean, obviously there's a real value in that when it comes to development work. Do you feel like the journalism piece like serves you well, or that underpinning in your career?
I absolutely do. And I don't think it's what I really expected to come out of my education in the journalism program. My focus was actually on advertising, and I learned pretty quickly that I didn't want to help market products to sell. I was really captivated by that storytelling element. And in particular, at the Reed School of Journalism at WVU at the time, they were doing a lot of really interesting work around storytelling in the state of West Virginia and communities around, old coal mines and how those communities were being had been impacted and were being rehabilitated. So I found all of that really fascinating and important.
Yeah, it's I think a really important part of the work, because buildings unto themselves are not, they can have important aspects, but it's really the way that people engaged with them, and telling that story is really important. I think a lot of it comes back to how do we tell stories, and I think that Seno Canal Trust does a great job of that and connecting it always back to people. And so maybe that's a good sort of segue to talking about the trust. What is the trust? For somebody who doesn't know, perhaps we even need to take a further step back and say, what is the Seno Canal? And then we'll talk about what it is, the trust. So for someone who's never visited the canal, how would you describe it? You know, what's your elevator pitch on what the canal is and why it matters?
Sure. So the Seno Canal, the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal National Historical Park, has an almost 2-century-long history, and it's very important in our early transportation history as a nation. Essentially, it was a canal that spanned from Georgetown in the District of Columbia, ran 184.5 miles to Cumberland, Maryland, transporting different goods to market, coal, lumber, agricultural goods. And it operated until, I think, around 1924, when it eventually closed due to competition from railroads and quite a bit of flooding.
And it's, well, I guess I'll ask the question that might be on some people's minds. Chesapeake and Ohio, but it only makes it to Cumberland. The Ohio River isn't in Cumberland. It's more out towards where you went to school. What happened there?
Yeah, so it didn't quite make it to its final end point there. I think, they pretty quickly ran out of money. And then by the time the railroad made it out that way, it kind of was not in its heyday any longer.
So it ends in 24. And how long until it sort of becomes this pristine or sort of gem of a national park unit?
Yeah, so it became a national historical park in 1971. So it did take quite some time to get to that point. There was a lot of important work that was done by a lot of people to help make that possible, bringing it into the national park system. I think between the late 30s and early 40s, the Civilian Conservation Corps was very active in rehabilitating the first 20 miles of the park from Georgetown and further to the west. And that really brought that area back quite a bit for more recreational purposes. Quite a bit of that 184.5 miles, though, kind of languished in disrepair. And it was finally transferred to the federal government. And I think at some point someone proposed turning it into a parkway. And in the early 50s, 1954, this is the 70th anniversary of this, Justice William O. Douglas and a band of really committed conservationists wanted to turn this space into a national park site, and actually walked the entire length of the canal. Challenged Washington Post editors to join them in that walk, and eventually got the Post on board with turning it into a national park site. Now, early 50s, still quite some time before 1971, so there was more work that had happened. But now one of the most visited national park sites in the nation, the most visited national historical park in the national park system.
Which is amazing. And when you think about those numbers, and I don't think people recognize that, because they may go and visit a specific part and maybe not see a lot of people, which kind of speaks to, you can actually have solitude in one of the most visited national historical parks in the country. Some of that is owed to the fact that it's 184 miles long. So It's a really, really long park. And it is... I also think a lot of times people kind of, I don't want to say lip service, but people talk about how great it is when nature and history combine. And sometimes that happens, or it's like, well, we got this little parklet next to our historic site, and that's kind of, there's our nature. But this is really both just as much a natural park as it is a historical park. You can go long stretches without seeing anything obviously man-made, other than the fact that you're on a man-made towpath.
Right.
But you get a lot of nature. I mean, can you kind of speak to the nature that it protects?
Sure. So it, you know, being the most visited historical park, it's also one of the most biodiverse national park units in the entire national park system. Because it is linear, it spans, I believe, four different physiographic provinces.
I'll take your word for that.
Not a biologist. Work with some really great ones. But there are a lot of really unique species that live here, flora and fauna. And one of the programs that we work to support on the conservation side is helping to raise funds to protect the park's rare, threatened, and endangered plant species. There have been over 200 of these plants identified in the park, but that number is dwindling. I believe in the last 20 years alone, there have only been about half of that number relocated. So we're working to raise funds to help with a plant propagation project that the park is partnering with the Mount Cuba Center on to collect seeds from these rare plants, propagate them, and then outplant them into the park to help augment these species and help them to thrive.
That's probably a perfect way, another segue here to kind of talking about what it is you do. You kind of gave us a little bit of a preview of the kind of projects that you do, which are so innovative and unique, and I'm always impressed by the work that you guys are doing. So talk to us about the Seno Canal Trust. When did it come along, and what does it do versus what the National Park Service does? So we know this is a National Park Service unit. The National Park is responsible for it. So what role do you have in all of this, and when did it come about?
Sure. So the Seno Canal Trust is the official philanthropic partner of the Seno Canal. So we were established in 2007. Because there was a need to raise funds for the park for preservation, conservation, and ongoing maintenance issues. And that's exactly what we do. Since 2007, each year we've provided increasingly robust support through funds for each of these initiatives, including education, as well as active volunteer programming throughout the park, community outreach and youth education programs, and of course, our unique and award-winning Canal Quarters interpretive program.
So it's how big of an organization? How many staff do you have? And then we'll talk about those different buckets and how you raise the money.
Yeah, so right now we're a staff of 15. We have a few part-time and then mostly full-time staff who are dedicated to program services, fundraising, and some advocacy work.
So, well, I think people listening, there's, you know, preservationists around the country who are either doing work in support of national parks, who may have people listening who work at friends groups. Talk to us about, we're going to focus in on Canal Quarters, but obviously you have sort of the plant species side and all that. When you say advocacy, what do you mean by advocacy?
So, one real piece of advocacy that we're helping the park with right now, this is a great example, we help to raise funds for the park's towpath resurfacing efforts. The towpath, very long, very old, needs a lot of maintenance. So the park has been doing a rehabilitation of the towpath for quite a few years, where they're putting a new crushed stone surface on to make it safer and more accessible for use. So as part of raising funds for that, the park works on submitting an application to the state of Maryland's Transportation Alternative Program. We help to have an online petition to gather signatures of support from canal users and canal lovers to help support that effort. So this year we're trying to get 2,000 signatures. Our deadline is actually this coming Friday to help the park with that application. And we also collect letters of support from elected officials and community organizations that really demonstrate the impact and the significance of a safe and accessible towpath around the state of Maryland.
That's awesome. I think that's really cool. And that's something that other preservation groups could kind of repurpose about supporting another partner or even their own grant application with, you know, sort of that petition side of showing people and funders the public support for these kinds of programs. And obviously it's been really successful, you know, and people could take a look at the work that you've done in Williamsport, which is where your headquarters is, you know, co-aligned there with the Park Service. But, you know, you have a restored aqueduct, which is pretty rare. You have a working lock and you have the turning basin. You can get on a boat there. So, you know, I mean, all of it's cool to visit, but I know Williamsport is a pretty neat place where you can kind of get the experience of almost all of it all jammed into one little spot right there.
It's true.
Yeah. So, and I mentioned a lock. So what is a lock when it comes to a canal? And then we'll talk about lock houses. And I think this is such a cool program. I tell people about this program all the time. And I sort of feel silly that we haven't had you on yet to talk about this, because I feel like there's so much potential for other sites to replicate the program that you guys have put together here. So it's not just about what it does for CNO, but I think that there's a big story here for a national audience about how to activate historic places. But tell us the history of the basic history of what is a lock and what is a lock house.
Okay. So locks were used to control the elevation of water within the canal. And lock keepers were required to answer the call of traveling boaters at any time of day or night to open or close the lock. I believe there are over 70 locks throughout the park, and there's a change in elevation of over 600 feet along the linear canal. The lock houses are really one of the most notable historic structures found along the canal. At the height of the canal's operation, these structures housed lock keepers and their families in exchange for housing and a small wage. And as I said, lock keepers operated the locks for the boats passing through.
And so you actually have to kind of like open up gates and move water through them, and it allows you to raise and lower a boat. And people have probably seen this before. Maybe you've had the opportunity to go on one. I grew up in upstate New York, and you got to go on the Erie Canal and sing the Erie Canal song and get to go up and down on a lock. And you can do that in Williamsport and some other areas on the canal. I think down in, is it Georgetown has a lock as well that works?
Great Falls also.
Great Falls as well. There we go. So there's a couple different places where you can experience this, but the lock house was where the lock keeper and their family lived, like you said, because you could get called out in the middle of the night. There's somebody coming down and you got to let them through. Okay.
Right.
So these lock houses, obviously the last time you mentioned the canal really ran was 1924. It's 2024. So it's 100 years later. And the lock houses before you guys took this program on were doing what?
So I'm not sure about quite a few of them. I know some were rehabilitated early on. One of them in particular, Lock House 10, which is part of our program, the Civilian Conservation Corps was active in helping to rehabilitate that house, I believe for park housing at the time. So it, you know, some of them have really sat for a period of time without adequate funds to help rehabilitate all of them. And that's why a program like ours is really critical to making sure that these houses and these historic structures can continue to be used going forward. So our program actively activates them and protects and preserves them for future use.
And so, I mean, we're kind of stepping along here in the story, but you how do you activate them? What's the method here?
So today, we have 7 lock houses that are currently part of our program, and visitors can either stay the night or have some other kind of daytime use or event at one of the structures. So it's an interpretive program. So each of the houses has been furnished and interpreted to reflect a period in the canal's 2-century-long history. So right now, those structures span from interpreting the 1830s all the way up to the 1950s. The 1950s referencing that Justice Douglas hike along the entire towpath.
Fascinating. So you can step back, stay in history. You can stay overnight. A lot of people do.
They do.
I always encourage people who are like, oh, well, I'd love to stay in the CNO Canal, but I don't like camping. And I'm like, well, wait, you don't have to camp. You can stay overnight. So the money that you guys generate, you keep to then do what with?
So the money stays within the program. So it supports the program's operations as well as the ongoing maintenance and preservation of these buildings. So things like if there's a leak in the building or an air conditioning unit and some of them goes bad or something in the kitchen goes out, we're able to have funds to make those necessary repairs. Other things like the roof and other larger exterior issues, we work with the National Park Service to help fund those.
And how long have you run it? And, you know, has it been successful? Can it sustain itself? Does it survive?
It's definitely surviving and thriving, I would say. So I want to say that we've had the Canal Quarters program going on since the trust's inception. The most recent house that we brought into the program was Swain's Lock House, Lock House 21, and that opened to the public in 2019. We are excited to be working with our park colleagues to work toward future expansion of the program and what that might look like. But it is a successful program. Each year we have around 3,000 visitors join us. We've had visitors from all 50 states except for North Dakota.
Are you hearing that, North Dakota? You got to get out here.
Someone's listening from North Dakota. Plan a trip to the CNO Canal.
That's right.
And then as well as international travelers. So we have roughly $200,000 on average coming in program support for Canal Quarters each year. And that directly goes back into the program.
And what is the average like overnight stay cost? And then I suppose if people are listening, if that North Dakota listener particularly is listening and wants to, you know, book a rental, how do they do all that? What does it cost, generally speaking, and how do you book?
Sure. So I mentioned we have 7 houses in the program right now. 3 of those we call full amenity or modern amenity. So that means that they have indoor plumbing and electricity, so you don't have to camp. Those have a bit of a higher fee. So I think those go from $200 to $240 each night. All houses sleep up to 8 people. We have a half amenity that has electricity, and then we have 3 rustics that have an outdoor toilet, porta potty, and an outdoor fire pit for cooking. So it's a really authentic rustic experience. So there's something there for everyone. And those run somewhere between $160 to $180 each night.
So it's a pretty good deal, really, when you're thinking about it compared to even like an Airbnb or something like that. Like, it's a great deal. And the experience is great because they're also, appropriately and authentically decorated and furnished. And you really get the feel as if you're camping or living in that specific period of time that the trust has chosen for that structure. So you're hoping to expand it. Where do people learn more about it?
So people can visit our website, canaltrust.org, to learn more about our organization as well as the Canal Quarters program in particular, and they can book their stay right there online.
So this is definitely, I'm sure it's already booking up for the summer. It's a pretty popular program. When you get to the summer months, do you have years where you're just completely booked?
You know, we do, and it kind of goes month by month. I would say spring through fall, particularly for the full amenities, we see sometimes 100% occupancy. So if we have 30 nights available, all 30 are booked. So they do fill up pretty fast.
That's awesome. I mean, that's what you want, right? And that encourages potential expansion. And I guess, you know, expansion and where you guys are headed is the final thing I want to talk to you about. So what are the big things on the horizon? What is the trust working on? What keeps you kind of going?
Yeah, so we're just completing our new strategic plan, which will really guide our work for the next 4 years. It's more of a strategic refresh. We didn't feel we needed to do a completely new plan. We're still very much committed to supporting the park with preservation efforts, including Canal Quarters and its expansion, more conservation work with the protection of conservation of rare, threatened, and endangered plants, more invasive plant management. We'll be increasing some of the support there, further building our canal community and strengthening our organization for our next phase of growth. We know that there are more staff positions that would always be helpful. So that's what we'll be working on. So stay tuned.
Yeah. And I suppose hopefully some more canal quarters, we could talk about those, particularly as they're underway. We would love to have you come back and kind of talk about a project as it's moving forward, because Absolutely. They're complicated also because it's federal property, but you have to raise money. And these are not easy things to raise money for, I would imagine. Is that a challenge? And how do you kind of message that?
Yeah, you know, it is an interesting challenge. I would say the first thing that really works in our favor is a strong partnership with the National Park Service. You know, ultimately, at our core, our mission is to help support the park. So making sure that we're aligned in our priorities is very critical. You know, what's so enjoyable about working for the trust is how much everyone we talk to loves the park, loves history, loves nature, and they want to be able to support it. So figuring out how to tell the story of the canal and the significance of a particular structure is really key in building those connections with people who could potentially help support a rehabilitation project. There are a lot of people who are interested in historic preservation and think that it's a terrific program. So, you know, we do have some really dedicated donors in our network who support general operations, volunteer work, but also canal quarters. So we're really fortunate to have that support out there.
Yeah. And I think the proof is in the pudding. You guys have done great work. And I know that donors respond to that. But I think that that's valuable for people to hear about how you kind of make the connection and having a real work product too, not just talking about the work, but they're able to go and stay in a building. So
right,
they can see its impact and the impact on people and this resource that millions of Americans enjoy from all walks of life. And you can do everything there from intense historical inquiry to just going out and walking and looking at the bluebells in the spring. I mean, it's kind of got a little bit of everything in there for everyone. Well, it's been, you know, so much fun to have you on and to kind of hear about this program and to share this program with the rest of the country, because everybody should know what's going on here and take a look at it. I think it's a really cool case study for activating or reactivating historic structures. So you'll have to come back when you do the next one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do also just want to add in, Nick, you know, we have a staff of 15, but we also have really dedicated long-term volunteers like our Canal Quarter Masters who help to care for these structures. So we have groups of volunteers who help us check in on the houses each week, do light maintenance. And we've actually had quite a few work days over the last few months where fresh painting has happened, cleaning up of the picnic areas around the houses. So our volunteers are really critical to making sure that this program is successful as well.
Well, that's a good final plug, because people can go to canaltrust.org and we'll put a link in the show notes and they could probably become a volunteer there pretty quickly as well. If they're listening and they're nearby, I'm sure Lauren can put them to work. So thanks so much for joining us today. It's so great to hear from you. And thanks for all the good work that you're doing for the CNO Canal.
Thank you, Nick. I really appreciate the opportunity, and thank you for all that you do with Preservation Maryland. It's really incredible what you all do for this region.
Thanks for listening to PreserveCast. To dig deeper into this episode's story, head over to preservecast.org for show notes and our collection of previous episodes. Don't forget to engage with this podcast by subscribing, commenting, and leaving a review. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at PreserveCast for even more. PreserveCast is currently recorded in Walkersville, Maryland, and sponsored by the 1772 Foundation and powered by Preservation Maryland. Thanks for listening, and keep on preserving.